which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Roll call, please.
Certainly. Commissioner Beckman?
Here.
Commissioner Bushy? Commissioner DiGiovanni?
Here.
Commissioner Boystein?
Yes, ma'am.
Commissioner Kelly?
Here.
And Commissioner Hilmer?
Here.
Thank you.
Okay, open period for public participation. I see none here for open period, unless Ken has something to say.
No comments.
All right. Consent calendar?
Second.
Discussion?
Yep.
Okay. Moved and seconded on the consent calendar. All in favor?
Aye.
Any ayes? None. No names. Okay, item 5, the cogeneration system pre-design completion. This is a recommendation to authorize staff to prepare a professional service agreement with Corolla Engineers for the cogen system design services.
So, thank you. So the cogeneration system evaluation report near completion, you recall this is a contract we entered into with Corolla Engineers back in October, and there were, you know, like 6 or 7 tasks, specific tasks in that contract, and they moved forward with most of those, and it's nearly wrapped up. And nearly all the tasks in this particular contract are funded by the State Water Board in terms of reimbursing us for the cost, because they're also components in the Renewable Energy Expansion Program agreement. So that's good news. So the in January, I share with you the results of the first task, which is the technology assessment, with 3 technologies were looked at, and the findings and recommendation were to select a cogeneration engine-based system. So we told you that's what we selected as a project team, and that we're moving forward into actual pre-design work with that type of a system. And the system that went into the pre-design, the size was a 850 kilowatt engine generator-based system that would be installed in an open bay in our salt handling building that interconnected with our biogas system and electricity and, you know, distribution system and our process control system. So the work's almost wrapped up, so we're in a position now that we could actually begin the final design work. So that would be comprised of you authorizing staff to develop a scope of work for the project, a fee estimate, and a design schedule, that we have bundled that into one of our standard professional services agreements, and then we bring that whole package to the board in the future for consideration or approval. So if that was authorized tonight, which is the staff recommendation, then we'd likely bring that to the board at the probably the May board meeting. Then those design fees we just incorporate into the draft and the final budget, because they'd be an element in the fiscal year 20 CIP. So in terms of the design cost, we've talked with Corolla a little bit, and what you do is you look at the coming up with just an estimate right now without going through a formal process where they detail out what the work is and, you know, the resources and the labor hours. You can say, here's the construction cost estimate, and depending on the size and the scale and complexity of the job, you can say a certain percentage of the construction cost is for the final design. You can do the same thing for engineering services and construction, and also construction management. So for a project like this, which is, it's not small, it's not really big, it's kind of medium-sized project for an agency like ours, it's about maybe 10% of the construction cost, which the pre-design conceptual construction cost is about $6 million. But the pre-design has been brought to about the 25% level. So a lot of design work's been completed. So we reduced that down to 8%, just to give you guys a flavor of what the design cost could be. Then we verified that with Corolla this afternoon. That's a pretty reasonable and conservative cost estimate without them looking at how much detail design work, how many sheets they have to produce, things like that. So what we're looking at right now would be kind of a rough estimate for the design fee, about $487,000. And we try to work with them to kind of reduce that a little bit if possible. So that's kind of what we're looking at right now without, you know, getting the agreement together in the scope of work. And the only thing to mention to you all is the selection of the capacity of the cogeneration system. So the current one's 750. The pre-design's pretty much been focused on the 850, which is the smallest, you know, size that's close to the 750 that's available nowadays. You recall we talked about, you know, last month in a little more detail in January, that there are two larger sizes, the 1065 kilowatt and the 1100 kilowatt. And each one's about $100,000 more than the next. Then there's some kind of general comments by the board that if we could accommodate it, it'd be better to have a bigger size system, more capacity. That way, if we expand the organic waste program, we'd have that capacity to generate more power and deliver more power for sale to MCE. So we mentioned that to Corollo, that we may select something bigger, maybe not. So during the pre-design, they also made sure that the two larger size units would fit in that open bay. Physical space, enough room for maintenance around them, and actually to remove them from out the roll-up door, too. So you can take the engine generation system out. It needs to be maintained at an off-site factory, you know, service provider. And we have, you know, enough, you know, electrical distribution system capacity for all the ancillary equipment associated with, you know, any of the three engines. So that was good news. So then in terms of the site, we looked at different, more detail into the options. So right now, our power purchase agreement with MCE is limited to 1,000 kilowatts maximum output, and we're at 750. And talking with them, they said, well, if you had something bigger than that, that's less than 1,000, that's okay. We can just change the nameplate as an amendment to the agreement, and that's fine. But we are limited to the 1.3 million kilowatt hour max capacity, which was the capacity of the 750. So as reported last month, if we picked the 850 or, you know, some like a D-rated larger one below 1,000 kilowatts, we would have a second power purchase agreement for the extra capacity, which would pay 2 cents less than the 10.5 cents we currently get. So we have 10.5 cents for first 1.3 million, then anything above that up to the capacity of the 850 or whatever, we get 8.5 cents. So we could use that kind of a structure going forward with either any of the three engines. So then it came down to, okay, do we derate one of the more expensive engines so we can come within that 1,000 kilowatts, or do we take a look at possibly, you know, preparing an application for a new feed-in tariff program that MCE has for systems from 1 megawatt to 5 megawatts? And I briefly mentioned this as an option last month. So I downloaded a big, thick, you know, contract and application for that FIT Plus program, and it's much more complicated in terms of PPA than our current program. And I guess they've said that the CPUC has rules that anything greater than 1,000 kilowatts has to be scheduled with the California Independent System Operator. But they would do that in this FIT Plus agreement, so that's a good thing. So reviewing the agreement, it was pretty clear that there's a lot more agency staff administration and energy tracking and communication with this Regis program, and they track energy credits and renewable energy generation. And what's became really apparent as a complex matter would be that we'd have to forecast the amount of energy we produce. We have to forecast annually, forecast monthly, forecast, I think, daily, mm-hmm. and submit that to them because they have to schedule that in. Mm-hmm. Then we'd have the opportunity the day before a particular day, we could change the amount that we forecast we're delivering. And if we don't deliver what we said we're going to deliver, there's a penalty associated with that. So based on just the additional administration work for staff and, you know, the forecast potential penalties, it doesn't seem like that I would recommend going down the path of the FIT Plus system and application. And that's really because the nature of the characteristics of the wastewater change on a daily basis. The amount of organic, you know, material that could come in changes on a daily basis. So it would be hard for us to predict on a daily basis how much material we would receive and how much biogas we would generate. Even if we had, like, say, long-term contracts with all these different suppliers of various liquid organic wastes, I doubt they would do that. But if we had something as nice as that, even the characteristics in different waste loads have different chemical oxygen demand characteristics and volatile solids characteristics, which result in different biogas generation. So this is just information now, so I probably wouldn't recommend moving into that contract structure due to the variability of this organic waste program. So then I took a closer look at the derating of one of the engines. So we looked at that, and then in the staff report, there's some cost analysis in here. So for example, if we selected the 850, And we utilize all the capacity under the two different, you know, purchase agreements that were each less than 1,000 kW, that we'd have an annual revenue of about $216,000, 10.5 cents and 8.5 cents. If we selected, say, a 1065, and we were able to use all this capacity, and it was derated to 995, so it's within that 1,000 kW, we'd have annual revenue approximately $319,000. So quite a bit more than the 850. And if we operated under that FIT plus, which is 8 cents per kilowatt hour now, for the whole capacity of, I just did it for the 1065, it'd be $326,000. So $6,000 more than the two structure with the derated. So that's kind of, you know, just kind of a high-level economic analysis of it. And then there was, a board member had a question about, you know, derating, if you derated and say the PCU rules changed or MCE was able to work out a different structure with us in terms of PPA. We did check with the manufacturer, and they say you can reverse the derating. You just need to put on a larger turbocharger and some larger fuel gas valves and get back up to whatever the capacity is. So we as an agency need to make a decision on the capacity we want to select sometime during the final design. You know, so I would assume that the final design period is maybe 7-8 months. So by midpoint to that, we'd probably want to have a decision made and provide that information to Kroll Engineers if we select Kroll Engineers. So that's kind of, you know, the update on the sizing. So our recommendation is just to authorize us to develop a professional service agreement.
I have a question, Jason. This will replace the existing 750, right?
This engine would be the primary generator. The 750 would be there, and it would be backup.
So it's just backup. So we're not planning on that to meet load.
No.
Okay. So all right. So we're looking at this. So we're going to meet all of our 100% of the agency's load, plus have enough available to sell to make $310,000.
If we were able to bring in enough additional organic material to generate the additional biogas to fuel the engine beyond, you know, whatever level that we were at the starting point. So, for example, if we had the 850 right now, because it's 25% more efficient than the 750, with the 190 cubic feet per minute of gas we're producing, we would be able to become energy self-sufficient as soon as we hit the start button and start to deliver power. Right now, the 750 is generating maybe, you know, 89-90% of our power. But with the 850, the efficiency, we're energy self-sufficient and we're delivering power as soon as it's started up. So then we have a little capacity left to bring in some organics to max out the 850. And if we had something bigger than whatever tariff structure, we just need to find more organics and bring them in. So our staff's been kind of waiting on hold before reaching out to, you know, wineries and all these different types of, you know, food processing and manufacturing facilities that have these high-strength liquid organic waste that they're finding homes for. But the good news, which is in my handout, is that today we did receive the permission to operate from PG&E. Yeah. We got the letter today. We sent it to MCE, give it to our consultant. Now we're going through the process to get the CEC renewable generator certification. So everything's kind of come together, which is great. So now as soon as we get that renewable generator certification, MCE has a bunch of things, which we got a month on their end before we get the green light. Once we get the green light, we'll start reaching out and trying to find other haulers. Maybe bring in, you know, one of our current fog haulers has higher strength fog loads, more concentration of fog, and they like to bring it here at night. So we could do that, and that way we have more balanced biogas generation during the day. There's things that our staff's looked into, but we haven't, you know, looked too deep until we had, you know, some of these other matters, you know, approved and addressed.
So, Jason, the project size for the permission to operate is 750.
That's right.
Are we going to need a new permission to operate when we get our new co-generator?
That will be a requirement.
Okay.
Well, PG&E, in the permission to operate letter, they say if you change your capacity, we have to let them know and talk
sure.
about it. And that's likely going to be, as we've talked about before, another type of electrical distribution system review. So once we have a design agreement in place and a design schedule in place, then we'll fill out an application with PG&E and other paperwork and talk to the interconnection project manager, who we've gotten to know really well, Rob Becker, over the last year and a half, and say, here's the situation, Rob. We're not going to deliver. I think interconnection agreement is up to 1,000 kW, but it's tied to that 750. So we're saying we'll still be under the 1,000 kW because of our on-site demand.
Right.
We'll never, even if we had the 1,100 in here, the most we'd ever export would be 5 to 6. And I brought that up with MC on a separate topic. So why can't we use the current PPA since we have this demand of at least 600? And that's assuming we have more energy efficiency activities here, which we have scheduled. So we get down to 600. The most we'll ever deliver to you guys for sale is 500, which is half of what this CPUC. And he says, it doesn't matter. It's what the nameplate is. And I said, even if the actual capacity is never going to reach that? And he just, yeah. And some of you that were on our ad hoc energy committee remember how inflexible MCE was. But, you know, there may be some opportunities to work with some of the board members.
Right. Can I speak to that for a minute?
Definitely.
So my colleague on the Corte Madera Council, Sloan Bailey, is on the Contracts Committee and the Executive Committee at MCE. So I talked to him about this little predicament because I think it's slightly absurd that we're not seeming to be able to work together here to advance a common goal, us and MCE. And to my pleasant surprise, Sloan sounded confident that he could talk to some of his fellow board members at MCE and get this hopefully reviewed again, and maybe there would be an opportunity for collaboration where there was not in the past. So I think that would be a huge win for MCE and for us, and I think that would open the door to us maxing out our cogeneration capacity here and advancing both our and MCE's goal of putting as much renewable energy onto the grid as we can. So,
well done.
I'll keep an eye on that and report back to you, and I hope it...
That is great news.
Hope it goes well.
Question?
Yeah.
Jason, wasn't there a precedent at MCE?
In the past, when they wouldn't...
That was the...
Yeah, you know, in summary, they said, well, here's our standard small generator power purchase agreement that our board's approved.
Right.
And, you know, we spent a lot of time, first staff, multiple meetings, and then with our committee, we had three committee meetings and ideas that we presented. And they were pretty inflexible about it.
So they're willing, apparently they've been willing to change.
We'll see. Sloan sounded confident. I don't want to assume anything, and you guys have been through this before and hit a wall, so I'm not by any means assuming that he's going to be able to move mountains where it wasn't possible in the past, but I'm happy with the initial signals here. So we'll see how it pans out.
So. Thanks for reaching out to me.
Yeah,
thanks.
So any kind of just general thoughts on the engine capacity options?
I have a couple of thoughts, if I may.
Sure.
First off, I want to thank you for responding to some of our questions, which was, can we change the capacity of the large the generators and then change back again? And you looked into that, and apparently it's fairly easy to do.
Yeah.
Strangely,
it just costs a little money.
Well, yeah, but in the long run, we're talking about 10 years and then plus. So we have a 10-year contract. The opportunity to renew that after 10 years, but also nobody knows what's going to happen in 5 years or 6 years or 7 years. So the good news is you're not asking us to make a decision as to size of the cogenerator tonight, and we don't need to make that. I'm interested in this organization being able to generate as much power as we can under the contracts that we're permitted without exceeding them. And so, you know, again, we can have a whole conversation about the size of the cogenerator this evening, but it's not necessary. And I don't think we should do that tonight. We have 7 months to do that. I'm pleased to hear that we're in clean energy may have some different views moving forward, but I'd be happy to suggest the contract with Curl to move forward.
Thank you.
Motion?
It would be, yeah. I would, if you'd like to make it, I'd have to do that. I'd authorize staff to prepare a professional services agreement with Corolla Engineers for the cogeneration system design services.
Second. Discussion then. I'm very much excited about this project. It is something that I think is great for our ratepayers, to not only that we are energy self-sufficient, and also that we will be able to generate enough to bring in revenue that will further reduce our ratepayers' costs. I'm concerned a little bit about the process of which we're moving forward right away with one Corollo being having a sort of a no-compete contract, basically. That has been, if we go back through the history of why is Corollo here, Corollo is a great engineering organization, nothing against Corollo. It's just the process that we go through selecting them for close to $750,000 worth of contract. When we're all said and done with Corollo, if you look back at the master plan into the preliminary design of this, we just went from one right into the other in order to get our application in for the state loan. And now we're going to hand them a $500,000 plus contract, if it's potentially up to $750,000 when you include services during construction and any other optional services we have. So process is very germane to what we do as a public agency. Also, just, you know, we're investing maybe close to $8 million into our plant, and it might be a good time just to pause and get some other eyeballs on technical review of the project, and just to make sure that we are sound in our decision-making moving forward as well. For this large investment, which we've only done once in our lifetime before when we put in the original cogen system. So I'm not personally in favor of just handing the contract and going into negotiations with Corollo right now to come back to the scope of work, and for those reasons.
That's a great point.
Yep. Can you address that?
Yeah, why wasn't the subject to competitive bidding?
We went through an RFP-based evaluation selection process for our master plan. And we started to roll out the end of that process. And one of the main tasks in that process was called biogas utilization. So they looked at the capacity of the digesters, how much material we receive, how much biogas we could generate. Then they even looked at different size generators and, you know, what would work with that much biogas, and it cost estimates. So a lot of the very preliminary work that's in here was done as part of the biogas utilization. Mm-hmm. So that was done. And we had in the CIP, you know, to go through a process to do design and construction for a new cogen system. Not necessarily pre-design. That wasn't part of, you know, the CIP plan. At the end of the summer, you know, this is a long story, but essentially our engineering manager left, and I started to oversee the renewable energy expansion program project, which was an agreement with the state with $500,000 in reimbursement funds. And when I did that, the state asked for a quarterly update so we could get justification for our first disbursement from them, which was, you know, $180,000 or something like that dollars. And I went back and I said, okay, so I had to get up to speed on everything. I generated this quarterly report. And then I saw that of these tasks, there were several that weren't even started yet, and you couldn't start them, and there was money for these tasks, which were important, until you had a selected project. And the way that the program was set up, it didn't lead to some initial tasks, it didn't lead to a selected project. So then looking at the available monies left, and that we needed a project, I kind of created this cogeneration engine pre-design evaluation project, and I pulled in all these activities that hadn't been started from the state agreement as tasks in this project, and then I said, well, let's do a technology assessment, because that wasn't the CIP. So I said, let's add that, and let's then do pre-design of that, so then we have some conceptual costs and some other good information that leads us into the financial evaluation, which was another task that hadn't been started yet. So I kind of scoped that out. And I talked with Corollo about it because they were finishing up on the master plan work. But we had a deadline of March 1st to finish everything. to get the reimbursement. So I said, well, if we can do this pre-design system evaluation, the technology assessment, the pre-design work, the CEQA, the air permitting, the financial modeling, and the report preparation in the next 6 months, and we can upload that on the state site, then we could, we're eligible to receive, what at that time was still another $400,000+. So I talked to the state, and they were agreeable to amend that agreement to include the technology assessment and to include the pre-design work and a transfer budget from some of these other tasks that we know we're going to need what we originally thought when we put that application together. And that was recently approved, that amendment, by the State Water Board. So that's how it kind of was constructed into this project to be eligible for those free monies. And that's why we selected Corolla, because Corolla was finishing up and they prepared the scope of work with me for this project.
And if you're using their free money, you don't have to do competitive bidding?
No. And competitive bidding is for construction. There's no state rules on competitive bidding or doing a competitive proposal evaluation process for a special district like us. And the state itself has various agencies. They may have their own policy rules for various things. But as a sanitary district, or as SRSD, a sanitation district, and other similar type of government forms, you select your professional service providers based on your own practices and policies that you establish as an organization. And we have those policies set up in our financial policy manual, where it talks about generally you go through an RFP process unless there's some reasons that we'd have to do that. And that staff has a lot of flexibility in how we determine that. So selecting Corolla was just the right time for this work, given not needing to get everything scoped out, an agreement to the board, approved, start the work in a very compact time frame to tap the other $375,000. So that's why we selected Corolla at that point in time. Normally, if we didn't have these time frames and milestones, we would have prepared an RFP. We would have sent it out to, 5, 6, 7 engineering firms that have worked with us in the past, that have worked with other agencies that did this type of work. And we had formed a committee, and we had evaluated proposals, and we'd come up with, selection criteria, and we'd go through an internal process, and we'd select somebody. We'd negotiate a scope and a fee and a schedule, we'd package it up in the agreement, and we'd bring it to the board. That's the normal process for this type of a project, or even smaller and larger projects. But this one, it just worked out with the timing and trying to get the money that we did it with Corolla. Now, the pre-design is at 25% level. So we could decide, okay, let's prepare an RFP. Let's send it out to some firms. Let's go through the process I explained. Let's negotiate a fee and a scope and a schedule and bring that back to the board. Maybe it's Corolla, maybe it's someone else. We could definitely do that. And that's definitely a little more transparent in terms of process. That would take, that would create, maybe a 3-month delay in the project, which is not that critical right now, but it's more staff work to do that. And like I was mentioning to Dean, that if we decided to do that, I'm not quite sure how many consultants would propose on it, because Corolla's already been here and worked through a 25% pre-design level. Then they'd have to review the pre-design, which would take, time, and just labor and cost on their end. So I'm just not, we could go any way the board wants to go, but just staff's recommendation based on, just efficiency in the process and, lowest cost, I'd recommend is what's in the staff report. But we could do, whatever you guys like.
The potential that other firms wouldn't bid notwithstanding, do you feel that it would be to the detriment of the project to have one firm do the 25% pre-design and then switch firms to carry out the rest of the project?
It wouldn't be necessarily detrimental. It just take more time, mm-hmm. and I'm pretty confident saying it would cost more, mm-hmm. because someone has to learn what that pre-design was and the basis for the design, and it's like they may have different ideas. Then they have to present the ideas to us and convince us to make a shift, and which all could happen. But this isn't a complex project. It's we have a tried and true technology. There's three sizes. It's going to fit in a spot. You interconnect it. You run conduit. You run, gas piping. It's not complicated. So someone may look at it and understand it. The most complicated thing is the control systems. And there's a bunch of diagrams you can't really read in here that show that pre-design information.
But so easy, why does it cost $500,000 to pre-design?
Oh, you prefer the final design?
Yeah.
It's just, that's just our estimate based on the 8% of the pre-design construction.
Okay.
And really, I mean, once you get done with the final design construction may be less than that, too. A lot of assumptions are made in the pre-design and rules of thumb and, you know, other types of factors that consultants use to approximate costs for electrical and mechanical without having any drawings in front of them to do a detailed, you know, takeoff.
And I appreciate the discussion. You kept us very informed when we were going down this road from the master plan, and you kept us informed of when we went to the pre-design with Corello and all the reasons why for getting that grant application and stuff in. But now we're at a point to make a decision for moving into sort of the final design. And, no harm done, but it's just it's all about sort of transparency and process right now.
Normally we'd use the process I was talking about with RFP and evaluation. That's a normal procedure for us. But those are the factors. We didn't use that in this case. And normally, we wouldn't change, as an agency, we wouldn't change consultants after a redesign. That's just, I mean, some organizations, they do that, and they have policies to do that. But we've never done that in the past. We go through a process, and once we select someone to begin the project, we carry forward with them, unless there's problems. You know, there's quality work issues, there's communication issues with our staff, not following, you know, our decisions. We haven't experienced that either, but I've heard of that at other agencies.
Public comment? There's been a motion in a second.
Can I ask one more question about these?
Yes, bring this
if I may, thank you. I just see in Corello's report here in multiple places it says that the nameplate capacity of the new cogeneration unit will be 850 kilowatts. That's not binding.
Right. Yeah, they just needed, you know, something to do the pre-design around.
Okay, sure.
So we selected it because that was
the
easiest choice, closest capacity.
Excellent, thank you.
Regarding technical review, we talked sort of about process, but also just getting a second set of eyeballs on just where we are right now, making sure we're going down the right track. Is there a way we can do, if the board selected to move forward with Corello in negotiation for the final design, is there a way to satisfy the or is it worth getting a second set of eyeballs on this in a technical review?
Yeah, there's no downside to doing that. I mean, this is a major agency project. It's, you know, a core element in our power delivery program, which has many pieces that we're working on, you know, concurrently. And we've done, you know, third-party engineering peer review on several projects in the past. Mm-hmm. And some of those have really confirmed what the designer is doing, which was good to know. And some they found some value engineering, you know, ways to do things different that save some money. Or that were maybe better from a constructability perspective, right, which was good for the contractor, you know, lower the construction cost. So it's always a good thing to do that. And if we're talking about a $6-plus million project for something as important as you guys know it is, that's a fine idea. And that's something if the board, you know, would like us to go down that path, you know, we could prepare, a letter, request for proposals, and send that to just a few, maybe two or three firms that we know have cogeneration expert staff, mechanical engineer types, and just seek proposals to do a peer review of the final design, or like the 90% design.
Do you have any sense of what that might cost?
I don't have a good sense of that.
I'd also like to understand more of why and what that would include, and I mean, if that's something we could approach separately after we move forward.
I mean, even if we chose to, let's say we said, okay, let's put out an RFP for the whole thing again, that idea...
It's not again.
we did. We put out RFP...
That's for the master plan.
Which is complete. That's a different sort of...
I understand, but if we said, let's put the brakes on, that idea of having a second set of eyes would be valid for whoever would, let's say you've got somebody who came in here and said, whoops, let's not do it that way that Carollo thought about. Let's do it this way over here, like what you were just saying, or take a different approach. Mm-hmm. As an agency, we might like to have a second set of eyes look at it.
But if we were clear on exactly what was being technically reviewed, we could really focus in on what we needed to do to be pretty project specific.
I'm not an expert, or I preface it by this is the second time this agency has done a cogeneration project. We've only done one. It's not sort of the standard wastewater treatment. I mean, it's becoming that way, but and people include cogen in their plants. But it's only we've only done one of these projects, so mm-hmm. it's not like putting a second digester, third digester in, or another clarification tank. It's a little more specialized. So are all our assumptions correct? Are we sizing this properly? Are we, you know, just all those steps before we invest another, $8 million into our plan? I'm the only one vote here. So.
I would definitely support just a third-party peer review. And you said that's something that we've done on projects before, so.
Yeah. And, we would, in the letter RFP that we put together, we'd we'd probably want them to look at the 50% design, meet with staff, review the 50% design, identify any value engineering, changes, any fatal flaws, and then have them take a look at the final design, or we call it 99% design. So we probably have two levels of their review. So they'd be looking at all the drawings. So there's the time to look at things, then to meet with us after the fact. There may be have to have a separate meeting with Carollo to discuss if there's disagreements on, something that, some aspect of the project. We'd build that into, a scope of work.
I was actually suggesting doing it now before we even launch into the final design. Once you get going on producing drawings, you're pretty much down the track. So we're all our ducks in a row now, and then maybe at 90% for the value engineering proposals.
Yeah, we can definitely. There's no need to start the final design. It'd just be nice to have a contract in place to have the number in the budget. So we could work on developing an agreement with the scope, and then concurrent we could have a peer review of the pre-design, and then later, some months later, we could have the peer review of the 90% design.
Does peer review include costs?
Yeah, they would take a look at the cost estimate also.
Well, not the cost of the design. Mm-hmm. The cost of the contract.
The construction contract? The estimated cost of the
design contract.
Oh, you mean a peer reviewer to review the design contract cost?
The fees that the designers are charging.
I mean that's kind of unusual. I've never heard that before. I mean, you could ask them to do that.
Yeah. Okay.
So, Dean, is your concern that maybe if we were to say right now, yes, let's authorize Carollo to go ahead with design, but let's also authorize peer review, is your concern that we might then, as Carollo is working on design, the peer reviewers might say, wait a minute, we see some big problems in pre-design, so the whole kind of premise of what Carollo is moving ahead on is maybe not ideal?
Correct.
Okay.
So what we'd do is we'd probably select somebody and hire them by maybe as early as April, late as we may, and they could review the pre-design because it's TM2, They could review that in the big drawings so they can see everything, discuss with us, discuss with Carollo, identify things that need to change in the final design. And then that gets rolled into the scope of work in the agreement. So we can time it to where that way we have the pre-design peer review wrapped up with any findings before we start the final design contract work. So we can sequence it like that.
Okay.
If we want to go forward with using Carollo.
We don't have any idea what this peer review contract will cost.
Well, I think that the peer review of the final design would be, we could do it in a couple pieces too. We could have the peer review of the final design, the pre-design, and then we have an optional peer review of the final design. So we can do it in two pieces, and then we decide if we want to do the peer review of the final design based on what they find in the pre-design. We could we could structure things like that.
Yeah.
And there, just you can see what the pre-design effort is here. I mean, it's just going to be just labor hours, just having the discipline-specific engineers sit there reviewing the drawings. So I would think that it wouldn't, you know, maybe less than 10,000 to do a full review of the pre-design with the evaluation report. And if they don't find much, then it'd probably be less.
And that sounds great.
And then you could, then we could have an optional item for them to do a peer review of the 90% design, something that we kind of determine internally if that's important.
Sounds great. So do we need two motions, or how do we want to do that?
Well, can we do, I could alter my, I'm happy to amend my original motion to say that I recommend authorizing staff to prepare a professional services agreement with Corolla Engineers for the cognitive system design, cogeneration system design services, and to authorize staff to arrange a peer review pre-design contract.
Yeah. That'd be something
with the thought that we might look at a 90% peer review as well.
Yeah. So we would ask, we would just ask them for a, you know, a scope and a fee and a schedule just for the peer review piece. And there'll be an optional, possibly we'll do that, but we won't ask for the cost for that yet. That way we'd, they would be within my signature authority, and we could execute it really fast and get them working on it. Just what fits into the schedule, so we have, you know, design budget numbers for our budget. Which is not that big a deal. We could always just amend the budget in the future anyways.
Dan, would that fit your concerns?
Sure.
Okay.
Sounds good.
I'll second that one.
Okay, it's been moved and seconded. Any further discussion? Seeing none. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Dean, thank you for catching that. Well,
thanks for a good discussion on that. That was great.
You're welcome. Okay, item six. Other post-employment benefits funding plan. This is a recommendation to approve the agency's proposed OPEB funding plan and provide comments and directions.
So I'm going to talk for a few minutes just about kind of the history of OPEB at the agency and the different tiers that are kind of touched on within the staff report. So back, you know, prior to 2010, the agency had one tier of a OPEB benefit. And OPEB for us just means medical after retirement benefits. So that tier was for all the retirees and all the those employees when they retire. And it was tied to, and it was a union contract and with similar type of arrangements with the unrepresented employees, it was tied to the San Francisco Bay Area single-payer Kaiser rate. So once you retire, you have that lifetime medical benefit. So that's what we had. And then around 2009, CMSA had to comply with a new GASB pronouncement, GASB 45. And that's where we had to hire an actuary, and they prepared a OPEB valuation report, which really looks at a few things, but it's what's the net present value of all of these OPEB benefits, which is medical retirement benefits. So a lot of assumptions about, you know, cost of medical increases, how many employees stay with the agency for so long, how long they live, things like that. At that time, we got the report back, and I think, you know, the value of all those future benefits was maybe $8 million, somewhere around that range. And we were actively involved in labor negotiations with our union and the unrepresented group at that time. So the board, in a discussion with labor negotiations, they decided, well, we should look at how we can reduce those future, you know, medical retirement costs for the agency. So we negotiated with the employee groups the tier two that's mentioned in here. What the tier two is, it says anybody hired after July 2010, you have two benefits. One is you have this minimum medical retirement contribution in state law, and that's the Public Employees Medical and Hospital Care Act. And that says that if you're a public employer and you have an employee that retires, you have a minimum contribution to their retirement benefit, and that's just in the law. So there's that piece, which is smaller than the Kaiser piece. And then there was, we established a medical after retirement account with a third-party trust, and we contributed 1.5% of those employees hired after that date into this trust fund. So when they retired, they had a pool of money in the trust fund that they can get, you know, reimbursement for eligible medical benefits. So that was set up in 2010. Now, going forward until, well, around that time then, two other things happened. The board said, well, let's set up a trust fund to pre-fund all of these OPEB benefits for all the people that were retired or employed before 2010. So we researched different types of trust funds, and we contracted with CalPERS for what we call the SERP. It's the California Employers Retirement Benefit Trust. So we set that up. And the board, we're going to the finance committee, and then the board, we decided that we were going to contribute that, for that fiscal year's budget, the net annual required contribution to the trust fund. And that's a calculation in the GASB 45 reports. And what it says is, here's this annual required contribution, here's what you pay to your retirees for their medical, and here's this balance. So we contributed that net ARC to the trust fund. So that was an annual payment. And the benefit of doing that under GASB 45 was that you didn't have to report that ARC on your financial statements as a liability. So we're pre-funding for future use, which is good, and we, you know, had a better net position on our financial statements. So we went forward now. Now it's 2017, and the grand jury issues a couple reports on pension liabilities and OPEB liabilities. CMSA, like many of the agencies, had to respond to that. So working with the board, we looked at one of their recommendations was that CMSA, your board, adopts a new policy or a revised policy that states that you're going to fund the GASB 75 actuarial determined contribution, not the 45 ARC, but the 75 ADC. We hadn't done the 75 analysis yet. So the board says, okay, we'll adopt that policy, and we'll guarantee that we'll fund that to our budget, which is another recommendation with the grand jury. Several months later, we actually worked with the finance committee. We revised our annual budget financial policy, which the board approved, that says each year we're going to fund the trust fund with this actual determined contribution amount. So that was in policy now, so we're going to do it. A few months later, we then hire the actuary to prepare our first GASB 75 valuation report, which replaced GASB 45. And a couple different things with GASB 75 is that you have to report the total liabilities on your financial statements, the whole thing of your OPEB valuation. And we learned at the time that, well, about a month later, talking with actuary, that the GASB 75 ADC is calculated in a completely different way than GASB 45 ARC. There's no relationship, and you can't make a comparison. So we were wondering, well, why is it then that the ADC that we're committed to funding in our budget is half the ARC? So we didn't know that at the time. So the board approved the current budget with the $43,000 for the trust fund funding. And at that time, we said, well, we'll take a look at this, and we'll come back with some explanations. We'll come back with a future OPEB funding plan. So that's why we're here tonight. Okay, so with that, I'm going to turn it over to Ken to present the funding plan.
Okay, thank you. Basically, the gist of what Jason's talking about is the difference between the ARC and the ADC. In very broad terms, is that the ARC did have a provision in it for actually funding the OPEB plan, whereas the ADC doesn't. So the ADC is just purely a change in liability. The ARC actually had a provision for funding, and so, you know, the two things are calculated very differently. Anyway, I'm going to work off of the spreadsheet, the attachment that's in this board memo, board memo number 6. So if you want to follow along, I'm just going to be working off of that. So so basically, we have the two-tier system that Jason talked about. And then we also, of course, you know, we talk a lot about the two-tiered benefit, but really we have a two-tiered obligation also when you calculate the total benefit obligation. So under Tier 1, the total obligation currently under the current actuary evaluation that we have is about $5.2 million in total. And the annual payment that we're making currently is around $210,000. And if we were to fully fund our benefit obligation right now to the full $5.2 million, the interest earnings from that at 7% would be somewhere around $364,000. And as you can see, the $364,000 that I'm talking about far exceeds the benefit payments, at least that we're currently making, $210,000. And it was in this analysis that I realized, oh, well, wait a minute, you know, we really don't want to get overfunded on this OPEB plan because it's irrevocable. You put money in it, if you're not spending it down, you can't get it out. So then we realize that we need to have this drawdown plan, and that was the impetus, and that's what gave rise to the calculation and preparation of this worksheet. So on the upper end, as I talked about, you know, we have this $5.2 million obligation right now, but then according to our actuary, around 20 years from now, we have 32 retirees currently receiving the full benefit, which is single, just the employee-only medical for life. And then we have 18 active employees that will receive that benefit, which is a total of 50 employees. That's the sum totality of all the employees that will receive this benefit, and then there's no more. And so in about 20 years, through mortality, you know, that those persons will start, you know, the ones receiving the benefit will start dropping off, or as he put it, tailed off in 20 years. So what I'm kind of like calling the ultimate obligation is that when all those people are gone and you're down to just the 44 employees that are just receiving the PEMCA minimum, that's going to be around a $2.2, maybe $2.5 million obligation. And so what we've kind of lined out here in this chart is, how do we get from, you know, the current $5 million obligation, how do we drop it down to $2 million without being overfunded? And so that's what we've crafted and come up with. So what we've laid out is just an annual contribution of $50,000 for 5 years. And then that puts it up to a total amount of monies within the trust of this $3.9 million, which is shown in the chart. And then for the following 15 years after that, we stop making that $50,000 annual contribution. And then for the following 15 years after that, we let the earnings from the trust pay the benefits. There'll be no cost from that point forward, you know, to the agency. Because from an accounting point of view, when you fund the trust, that's an expense on the agency's books. But when you're just paying benefits from the trust, there's no expense on the books. So that'll be kind of a different dynamic, you know, not to have an OPEB cost, but, you know, but that's a good thing.
So like right now, if you look at the last column, that's the actual payment we make to the retirees who receive the benefit. So it's going up based on this escalation assumption.
Yeah.
So once we start drawing money from the trust, that last column shows you the operating account savings that we're not going to have anymore.
That's right.
Because that's trust money that's using to pay for all those retiree, you know, actual expenses for medical.
That's correct. So at any rate, when you get down to the end of the 20-year period that we're talking about, the trust is drawn down to somewhere around $2.7 million. The interest earnings at that point are less than the cost, but that's okay because that's what we wanted to do, was to draw it down. And then, of course, the balancing of all those numbers from that point forward, those will be future people that, you know, certainly won't be me. I won't be here in 20 years. And, you know, that'll be details for others to come up with. So that's kind of the gist of what we're talking about.
Oh, wait a minute. This is all based on 7% interest.
Yes.
What happens if it's not 7%?
Then that'll also be recalculated. We're going to be monitoring these things, you know, for the first five-year buildup, and then basically, you know, future staff, you know, will need to monitor that, you know, from, you know, year by year from that point forward.
So we'll be doing some sort of annual calculation and some sort of true up.
That's correct.
If this gets too far out.
That's correct. The SERP, which is amazing to me, is actually earning like 9.2%. It's doing very, very well. And so I just put in 7% for conservatism.
Also, we mentioned to Jason that Ross Valley just invested a lot of money in a actuary software program that's superior to all the other programs we think we've looked at, and it's given us real insight into our OPEB, and we're about to get insight into our pension liability. The first was depressing, the second will be depressing, but it's actual numbers, and we're hoping to be able to share those services with CMSA, so that one of the things that's nice about it is you can plug things in live, and it gives you a long-term understanding of where you are as things change. Because right now we're using an actuary who's got to take all these things and go away and come back and...
And he just plugs it in a computer program to generate the numbers.
Right.
Yeah, so really this plan is just let's fund for so many years to get the account balance to a certain level, and then let's start drawing it down, save the operating expense, and not overfund. That's the objective. And then each year we monitor the interest rate, like Mary Beth said, monitor the actual value of the fund. Maybe we have to increase the amount of contributions. Maybe we decrease it.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe the actual medical costs increase beyond the 4%. That's an annual checkup to update, you know, some form of this table.
That's correct.
So that way we have a proper funding mechanism and a withdrawal mechanism.
Technically, we don't have a proper funding mechanism because the way it should be, if we were prescient and could predict everything accurately, we would have an annual contribution that would exactly match our outflow, so that we would always have exactly what we needed. Now, we can't because we can't see the future, but I mean, this is a plan that basically puts all the costs of this particular service in the beginning years, and then you have 15 years of, you know, basically free time, and that's not how you should be doing this. I think that this is a plan to overfund or to prefund by many, many years. So, right?
Well, if you just contribute the EDC each year, there's certainly nothing wrong with that plan, except that, you know, you are paying that out. And so, you know, we could take advantage of these high earnings, and we could just contribute $50,000 a year for 5 years, and then the earnings from the fund, you know, pay the obligations, you know, from that point forward, at least for the next 15 years. And so there's two different ways that you can do it. Sure.
So it's sort of making like a sinking fund on...
And the ADC right now, the residual right now, I just estimated around off to $50,000. The ADC lease for 6/30/18 was $43,000. So we're not far from that residual anyway. So, because the ADC was like $253,000, I think it was, and there was $43,000 left over after the payments to the retirees' beneficiaries. So,
the last thing I'd want to do is underfund our OPEB or pension liability. I think we need to step up our funding for these two, so that, you know, we've seen so much get out of control that I'd rather use conservative estimates on interest rates and conservative or expansive estimates on our participation, so that we're in the best shape. I mean, I don't want to see us in bad shape.
Right.
Well, I absolutely agree. Although I would say that something worse than underfunding is overfunding.
Well, you can't get the money back, but if you're underfunding, let me clarify, we're funding this for 5 years on this plan, but this is a 20-year plan. So
that's correct.
We're not going to be in a situation where we're overfunding and not being able to get the money back because it's going into a trust fund.
We're going to be monitoring it annually.
Right, this is not a locked-in plan. This is kind of the conceptual plan we think makes sense right now based on, you know, 44 employees going to the future. You know, that's all. If we have more than that, then it changes, mm-hmm. you know, the medical costs on here, at least for a year, 20 beyond, assuming that all those Tier 1 people, you know, move on. I don't want to move on in 20 years.
Well, we're elected, so we'll certainly be here.
So the key thing is we just wanted to show the board we're thinking about this. We don't want to overfund, which we discovered we could. It's good for us to have some kind of a plan to fund to a certain level and draw from the fund to save the operating expense while tracking on it every year in terms of interest, in terms of the SERPT, you know, balance, in terms of what the actual medical costs are that year. And it's something through the budgeting process, we'll just update this based on all of the new realities. And this is something that we can bring to the board as part of or the finance committee is part of the budget process, and it could even be the attachment in our budgets.
And for example, you know, I just plugged in an even $50,000 just for, you know, kind of convenience, because it's close to what we had last year as the ADC. But we have a budget policy, you know, to fund the ADC. So You know, if, for example, the ADC is $150,000 and the cost, let's just say, is $190,000, well, then actually that contribution would be $60,000 because we've already, you know, had a policy to budget, you know, up to the ADC. So, and of course, it could go the other way, too.
And our next GASB 75 valuation report, we have to do that every 3 years,
yeah.
That's going to have a new ADC number in it. So then we would, you know, that'd be 2 years from now, then we plug in the new, and this is the net ADC, too.
That's correct.
Yeah, so we put in the new ADC number based on that. Or the board could select any number. It just needs to be a number to get the funding up to where we start to draw down based on the interest rate and the medical expense, that we get to around that $2.2 million in year 20, which is the current valuation of those 44 employees and the PEMCA, but the PEMCA is going to increase also each year. So that's why you have to monitor each year. But I even think we can kind of refine this and bring this balance down to 2.2, not the 2.7. Right?
Yeah.
Because that is overfunding right now, based on...
Right.
So we could refine the ADC contribution so we're not overfunded and say, this is the plan for next year. And we think if the board thinks it's as good as a conceptual plan for us to track each year, that we kind of write it into the budget financial policy, that we have this, we utilize this tool, we funded the ADC, we monitor and update this each year, report it out to the finance committee, so that way it's in policy, we don't forget about this. With strictly, we don't overfund the projected trust fund amounts.
I'd be prepared to move that we approve the agency's proposed OPEB funding plan with directions to staff to closely monitor this.
Yes.
Okay.
So thank you.
And write that into a policy?
Yes, please.
Okay. And so we'll bring the policy back to the board next month so you can look at the language we added.
Okay. It's been moved and seconded. Any further discussion? Seeing that. All in favor?
Aye.
Any notes? Seeing that? Okay,
thanks, Bill. That's great.
Okay, item 7, self-insuring the agency's dental benefits. And this is a recommendation to consider the agency's self-insured dental benefits proposal and provide comments and direction to the general manager.
So I'll give a brief history, then I'll turn it over to Ken a lot sooner than last time. So this is just, so we have a two-tier dental benefit right now. We've had this in place before I started the agency in 1993, so probably like in 1990, 1991. And the first tier is that we provide each employee and their dependents medical insurance through Delta Dental right now, and that's at $1,000 for each employee independent. And then there's a schedule with Delta, and a lot of things are 100% covered, some things is co-payment. And anything exceeding that $1,000 for the employer or dependent, we have another benefit that is a self-insured benefit, but we'll reimburse the employer or the dependent for dental procedure amounts in excess of $1,000. So for example, if I go in and say I have a bunch of work done and it's $1,650, that gets submitted by the dentist to Delta. Delta pays the dentist $1,000, so I'm maxed out for the year. I'll get a report from Delta that says, okay, you have $650. I pay that to the dentist. Then I bring that in with my receipt to the agency. They'd review it to make sure it's all proper. Then they'd reimburse me the $650 through that self-insured benefit. So that's kind of how it works, that two-tier plan. So Ken was approached by a third-party administrator. They said, hey, we can design a plan for you that will save you a lot of money. We can do an analysis of your dental, you know, expenses, projected dental expenses based on history, and we could provide something that looks pretty favorable. And so we've done that, and Ken's going to present that. But one thing to point out, one of the principals at this third-party administrator, Edis, he was, a city council member in, like, Redwood City?
That's correct.
For many years.
Yeah.
And he was also then appointed onto the Silicon Valley Clean Water Agency, JPA board, which is a wastewater agency like us, and he was on that board for many, many years. And on that board, he participated in CASA, he was involved with CSRMA, like on that board now. So he knows about the wastewater industry and what we do for our business. And so he's the person that Ken's been interfacing with to develop this proposal. So with that, I'll turn it over to Ken.
Okay, thank you, Jason. So, So let me just kind of like pick up where Jason left off. So one of the problems, I don't think it's a huge problem, but one of the problems is that because we do this reimbursement in-house, technically anyway, there's a HIPAA, requirement that we're not supposed to be seeing confidential medical information. So we're technically anyway out of compliance with that. And so by having this third-party administrator, we would close that loophole. So basically, the plan would be to use the third-party administrator. The third-party administrator would provide a card, a dental card, to all employees. Employees would provide the card. You can go to any dentist you want, so there's no more in-network, out-of-network, issues whatsoever. And then, the dentist, bills the TPA, and the TPA pays the dentist. The costs, currently, we pay $92,000. It's like $91,800, very close. To Delta Dental for the $1,000 worth of coverage, and then we pay, it's approximately $12,000 for those that exceed the first $1,000. So we're paying about $104,000 for dental coverage for the $2,000 per year benefit plan. And interesting is that we have 92 covered persons between the employee, spouses, and dependents, and we're paying $92,000. So basically, we're fully funding the whole benefit, which really seems odd to me because there should be some benefit of insurance. There's basically no assumption of risk on the part of Delta Dental. We're basically just funding them, and then regardless of whether the benefit is used or not, by the employee or dependents or spouses, they're receiving that, which essentially would be, profit for them. So that's just an interesting dynamic. So with the proposal...
Every insurance, dental insurance policy I've ever seen has been that way. Yeah. The dental people will pay. It never works out. I don't know why anybody. That's how it's always looked like to me.
Oh, okay. I did not know that. That was just a very odd thing that I picked notice as, wait a minute, we're fully funding. It's sort of like cable television or something, where you pay a flat amount each month whether you watch the TV or not. I mean, it's sort of the same thing. So anyway.
We're surprised by it. We just weren't aware.
Very surprised. So the consultant that we talked with, Edis, Employer-Driven Insurance Services, experienced, well-known, been around about 25 years, spoke with the references, the very strong references. He said that they're very... customer service oriented. You call them and they basically bend over backwards, with any question or issue that you may have. They provided a proposal and estimated that, well, with your, particular census, employee census, with your 92 covered lives or covered employee or covered persons, we estimate that the cost would be somewhere around $33,250. And then that combined with their annual fee, runs the total costs to Edis up to around $45,000, and then there will be some significant savings to the district. Assuming that their numbers are correct, but when I spoke with the references, yes, well, the numbers that they say it is, that's what it is. That's what they told me. So, assuming that is accurate, and assuming that, like, for example, if we did want to proceed and move forward, there are benefits to the employer and to the employee. I'll begin with the benefits to the employer. Substantial savings per year from the Tier 1 Delta Dental Plan. That's at least $50,000 worth of savings. You have $104,000 and around $45,000 cost. That's like a $59,000 savings, but it seems like there's like at least $50,000 of savings. We would comply with a HIPAA requirement. We would streamline the process from a two-tier plan into one plan. The employer, which would be very important for us, would have a web portal and where we would get information on plan utilization. We could use that for trends and forecasting and budgeting purposes. We wouldn't have names, but we'd know, so many people are doing expensive things, or so many people are doing, less expensive things. So that would be a good tool for budgeting purposes. We would be working with a stable, experienced TPA for administrative services, claims adjudication. As I mentioned, the strong references, very strong in customer service. Benefits to the employee is that we would propose increasing the benefit to $2,500 from the current $2,000. That seems to be kind of the going amount now. It's been $2,000 ever since I was here the first time back in the early 1990s, so it hasn't been changed probably ever. Orthodontics benefits, we would do the same thing. We'd increase that to $1,500 from $900. All other benefits would remain the same, just as the Delta Dental plan. That's one of the things that we would need to do, is to craft our benefit worksheet, and then we need to have that approved to make sure that everyone's on the same page and what's officially approved and what's not approved. There would be no networks for the employees. They could choose any dentist that they want. No out-of-pocket expenses other than the copay. And the employee also would have a web portal so that they could see their own personal utilization. Just as some due diligence, I did check with Delta Dental, and they said that they would give us a 5% reduction for a period of 1 year. That would occur with the renewal, which is in December of 19. And that then they also said that should we terminate and go away, that if we did want to come back, we could certainly come back, but they would re-rate us as a new customer, which if that means a new, if that means higher prices, I don't know, but that's what they said, and it was in an email. So to me, their fees seem excessive, and it just from the point of view that, you know, they're not assuming any risks, you know, of insurance, and you know, for those reasons, you know, we're kind of, you know, recommend moving forward with this, but of course it's up to you, or maybe you have some other insight information that you could provide. The next steps, should we proceed, we need to inform the employees about the potential change. We need to prepare our dental benefits worksheet, and that would need to be approved. We need to meet and confer with the union, and we could do that easily because we have this market survey coming up soon. For transition purposes, you want to make sure that there's no employees that has anything that's work in process, you know, so that they don't get, you know, cheated out of that, you know, before you made the change. So make sure that that's all cleared up. And then, of course, approve a contract, terminate with Delta, and then provide training on the use of EDIS and on the web portals. So
the contract would come back to the board. So really, in a nutshell, by looking at this, we're thinking, well, there's some good cost savings for the agency. As Ken mentioned, you know, benefits to the employee, benefits to the agency. There's not really a downside to it. We could save a bunch of money. And worst case would be a lot of employees and dependents had real expensive procedures. So the 30-something thousand we had in this fund that it had, that got used up, and they just want us to transfer some more money over. That would be the worst case. But I'm sure it wouldn't be close to the 92,000 that we're paying Delta for procedures. So it seems like it's at this level, a win-win for everybody involved.
Not for Delta, no.
Well, that's right. Not for Delta. But, so our recommendation is to provide us direction to move forward with the next steps.
Yeah, it almost sounds too good to be true.
My only question is, why are we... this seems like something that the general manager should be able to take care of. Is this not within your signature authority?
It's a change in benefits.
Oh, it's a change in benefits, yeah. That has to come to the board?
Oh, yeah. I can't just implement new benefits and change the benefits. At least you haven't delegated that to me yet. I feel better, you know, just bringing these type of benefit changes to the board because, you know, we have to have a contract with them eventually and we have to meet and confer on this and negotiate.
Yeah.
And that's something that, you know, we may need to bring forward to closed session if there's issues with that. But we're going to try to bundle this negotiations with our personnel policy manual, which is under review now by the union, changes to that. And we have the market survey. We got the results of that. And that looks really good. Everybody's, you know, doing pretty well compared to others. So there's three things that we're working with the union on right now, and this will be integrated in. Then also, ultimately, we have, you know, our dental benefit section in our personnel policies. So that's something that the board would have to approve the business of that to align with the new program.
I think the board should approve this promptly. I move that we approve the self-insured dental benefits proposal.
Second. One discussion item. So we classify this still as a dental benefit in our job announcements and recruitment and stuff like that.
Yeah, it wouldn't change from what we currently have, the two-tier system. We'd still define it as a benefit.
Right.
Yeah.
And there's no adverse tax implications to the employees since it's really they're just the
benefits are non-taxed.
Right.
That's
so
correct.
It still remains the same.
Yes.
It's been moved and seconded. Any further discussion? Okay, all in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Thank you.
Yes. No notes.
Thanks, okay. Thanks, Kevin.
Thank you. You're welcome.
Thank you.
Go get some market bills like that.
Great. Cost savings measures. Okay, item 8, the draft San Quentin State Prison Wastewater Service Agreement. This is a recommendation to review the draft San Quentin State Prison Wastewater Service Agreement and provide comments and directions to the general manager as appropriate.
Thank you. Yeah, so our, we have a wastewater service agreement with the Department of Corrections to provide the wastewater services to San Quentin. There's three different services that we provide. One is, you know, wastewater treatment and biosolids management, operation and maintenance of the pump station, and also they provide, you know, their share of our debt service. So that's built into the agreement, and there's a lot of assumptions for costs, and there's not to exceed amounts in the current agreement. In the current agreements, that in effect for almost 5 years and expires, you know, at the end of June. So we started discussing this with CDCR staff in Sacramento in the fall, and we agreed to start working on it, which meant that they asked me to revise the agreement for them to review. So I did that, and what you have attached are really the final revisions to the agreement in red line strikeout. And there's a lot of just cleanup of the language of the agreement. There's only a few things that I think are worth pointing out, you know, the staff to you. One is that there was a major initiative in the original agreement where we did a full condition assessment of their pump station and assets. So that's been completed, and so we removed that provision from the agreement. And based on the condition assessment, you know, work we did, we prepared a 10-year kind of asset management capital improvement program. So we've been implementing that each year with the extra services amounts in the annual purchase orders that are tied to the agreement. So that was one. Second is, and we've talked briefly about this in the past, is that the low-security inmates at the prison have been moved out, and the ones that are remaining work for the volunteer fire department for the prison grounds. Historically, there was a group of low-security inmates that cleaned the bar racks or screens at the pump station. What those are is all the wastewater from the whole prison comes to one big main pump station, and there's two channels that the water flows through, and there's big metal just racks in the channels that collect all the debris, which most of that is flushed by the prisoners down their toilets and their cells. So there's a prisoner that's in a little building there. His job is to go out every hour and a half and clean the material off the racks, put it in a dumpster, a garbage can, take it to a dumpster, and that's their job. Well, in discussions of revising the contract, you know, the San Quentin staff said, well, you know, we don't have these inmates anymore. It's looking like we're going to have to then have CDCR staff do this screening. And that's going to cost us a lot of money, and that comes out of a certain part of their budget. And they're really concerned about that. And they said, well, Stephen, say, you guys have a certain not-to-exceed amount each year, and we're always being asked by the Department of General Services, why is there always extra money in the PO each year? And I said, well, it's based on not-to-exceed, and there's extra work there, and some years we don't have to implement that. I said, but in the new agreement, what we can do is we can start moving some monies around to provide the funding for CMSA to hire employees to do this bar rack screening, so that way you guys don't have to have CDR staff. They like the concept. So I've integrated that into the agreement. And it's very general in here. It just says that we'll provide that service from 6 a.m. to 10 p.m., which is the time right before the inmates get up until after their bed and lights out. They said there's very little activity after 10 o'clock. They would handle the screen cleaning with their own staff in the after hours. So we wrote that into the scope of work. And the only other change in the scope of work is just the authorization for us to use flow information and maintenance work information in our various routine reports here, like we've been doing for a long time based on a verbal approval, but now we wrote it into the agreement. Then there's some minor invoicing procedure changes just to reflect how we invoice. They originally wanted lots of supporting documentation and invoices within a certain time frame in the agreement, but then after we signed the first invoice 4.5 years ago, they said, we don't want any information, we just want the cover sheet with the amount of money on it, and we'll pay you. And we said, okay. So we wrote that into the agreement. So that's a change in really the scope of work. When you look through it, there's a lot of red, but those are the main ones. Then in the second exhibit is the budget detail. So you can see up top under item A1 how monies have been moved from the three categories so we can fully fund that pump station maintenance. And that assumes a certain pay rate for the certain, you know, monthly salary rate, total compensation rate, people at the top step of their step, you know, in their step range, incorporated into the regular pump station O&M work. So there's still plenty of funds in the wastewater treatment, because right this year, based on the flow and strength allocation method we use for everybody, I think the revenue from them is only $515,000. So this adds a $300,000 buffer in the event that the allocation changes based on member agency activities and so forth. So the total for the contract hasn't changed. We just reallocated money. And the debt service has always also decreased because, remember, we refinanced the revenue bonds. The debt service decreased in coverage, and the board at that time decided, okay, we need to apply that decrease also to San Quentin, which they appreciated that a few years ago when that happened. So then in terms of extra services, you can see on page 2 of this exhibit that we have that not to exceed fee each year. Then we have $1.1 million in extra service work. So the difference there in the current agreement is $150,000 a year, and it doesn't roll over. So if you don't use that $150,000, it's gone. If you don't use all that not to exceed money, it's gone. It's just released back to the state. Under this, it still works that way for the wastewater services, but the extra services is just a pot of money to be used over the whole 5 years. And that $1.1 million is based on the last exhibit, which is our detailed, you know, kind of asset management repair schedule, which has all these detailed projects from the assessment report that the engineering company that did the report updated for us for this agreement with contingency. So that's where the $1.1 million comes from. So the way this stands, also the pump station O&M task, that's been significantly reviewed to reflect the actualities. I didn't show it in red line strikeout because it's just be hard to track everything that happened in there. But those are primarily the changes I wanted to point out to you. The state at San Quentin and the asset management division in Sacramento, they've accepted all these changes, and they've sent this package to the Office of Business Services to bundle into a contract and start moving through that approval process. So they're fine with everything. And they did say that it's taking a long time to have that division approve the contracts. So what they've done also, they've submitted a one-year contract extension, so there's no change in services or anything like that. They said once that'll get approved sooner than later, that once this is approved by the OBS, then they'll terminate that one-year contract extension of the current contract. So this is just to present to you, you know, what we worked on, what they've accepted, get any feedback, and once this is approved by the state, then I'll bring back this contract to the board for your consideration approval.
I want to remind the board that Jason was kind enough to give me a tour of San Quentin and what we're doing there. And I appreciated that time that you gave me, so I understand the scope of work you're doing. We also talked about San Quentin paying for these three employees who will be working for us when they're not working this great cleaning job. So I think it's a real benefit to CMSA. But more importantly, the reason that they're running out of employees is because the last one escaped, working for us, carjacked a car and escaped, carjacked a car, which he was in prison for. Some people are just not
skill set.
Right.
Did he only have 6 months left or something?
Yeah, something like that. He was way too close.
We own anything of value that's found in those grates, right?
Which is mostly drugs, which I understand.
No.
Anyway, gentlemen, returning to the draft San Quentin State Prison Wastewater Service Agreement, I move that we approve it.
It's just a review and direction.
Oh, are we not approving it?
You could conditionally approve it.
That's right.
I mean,
we talked.
But I bring back, if you're fine with all the changes, and there's nothing significant, then this would just be a consent count item in the future once the state approves it.
I'm fine with the changes, so I'd second the conditional approval.
Sounds a great idea.
I'd just like to say very good job on all the edits. And
thank you.
You answered my questions regarding costs, why things went down and shuffled around. So very good explanation that I didn't even have to ask a question.
Thank you.
So you precluded my questions.
Regarding so we've estimated it would take 3 employees to provide that service 24/7, including holidays and coverage. like I mentioned before, we'll focus recruitment just within the service area for those employees. And we have a job description. The next thing that we've drafted up is based on similar type of functions at other agencies that have similar type of prison, you know, that they do work at. And so we wouldn't start a recruitment for the employees until we had the contract approved.
Which is like, do you think 7 months?
It could be, you know, a month or two. It's just asset management staff just thought it could be a while, so they had the extension. But once, you know, they approve it, then we could, you know, bring it back to the board, and then we get authorization to begin the recruitment. And that'll be a targeted, you know, quick recruitment internally. And
who's doing the cleaning of the grates currently?
Low security inmate.
The same kind of one that walked around the edge.
Yeah, I assume so. Okay. Yeah.
Maybe. We'll leave that to the department.
So, we look forward to having this return on the consent agenda. Thank you.
Yes, very well done.
Okay, great.
And that's a great segue into item 9, the new institutional utility.
But did we take a vote on that last one?
Did you want us to vote?
You could.
Yeah, because we had voted. She made a motion of conditional improvement. I seconded that.
Let's take a vote on it, and then you can just put it on consent calendar in the follow-up meeting.
Okay.
So all in favor of approving the San Quentin Wastewater Services Agreement?
Aye.
Great.
Great, thank you.
Okay. Well, item 9 is the new institutional utility labor classification for the San Quentin Pump Station Maintenance. And this is to review the draft CMSA job description and provide comments.
Yeah, so this is just a follow-on for what we were discussing. So this is the draft job description that that our staff prepared and I reviewed. And I did work with our employment law attorney a little bit on this because we wanted to make sure that this is a temporary hire position because it's tied to the funding in the contract. We want to make sure that it's not just a full-time regular CMSA employee. So they receive benefits. They'd get, you know, compensated, they'd be a full-time employee, but they'd be categorized as a temporary hire. So if we ever, like, didn't have this contract in the future, we would have to let these employees go. And we'll actually write that into their employment agreements also. So their employment attorney helped with the language in the summary section. Then our staff prepared the essential duties and responsibilities. Then a lot of the other qualifications, that's pretty standard for this type of employee. We also have the special requirements on page 3, which said that they have to pass the Department of Corrections background check to have access to the prison property. It's very important.
Can I say it?
Pardon?
Wouldn't they also have to, as a special requirement, agree to follow all San Quentin rules and regulations, including the original contract says we have to report any misconduct. So if they come across a prisoner, they're required by law, by the contract, to report that, because we don't want to find out later there was an incident and San Quentin now says, well, there was an incident, you didn't tell us.
Yeah. That's correct. That's a contract requirement that we have. So any employee that goes out there has to follow that.
Yeah. Wouldn't that be?
We could include this job description, that's for sure. We don't include any of other job descriptions.
Do we have other people going to San Quentin on a regular basis?
Yeah, we have a whole pool of employees that go there every day. Yeah. Even I pass the background check to go out there. I have this card. But that's something that we could put specifically in this agreement. That's a fine thing to add. Or it could be something that we add into the employment agreements.
Oh, I think that makes sense.
Yeah. So one thing I didn't mention is, so it's really part-time work at San Quentin,
right?
Because they're out there at a certain frequency. But then they're at CMSA, so that's they're also going to hang out. Mm-hmm. So they'll be doing, you know, various tasks here in the maintenance department. Yeah, painting things, landscaping, custodial work, various other activities to help beautify and maintain, you know, the grounds and structures and things like that. Which benefits the agency to have those extra resources to do that work. Yeah, so the compensation range is what we're proposing for this classification is $23.99 to $29.16 an hour. Plus, they'd have full agency benefits. That's, you know, CalPERS retirement, they stay through the whole time. And, you know, medical and dental and vision. And so the salary range with all the weighting of the benefits for the three employees is from 217 to 273 a year. So say we hired three people at the entry level range. At the end of the top step, their total compensation would be about 273.
That's for all three put together.
That's for all three put together, and that's been incorporated, plus additional funds in that pump station OEM budget in the San Quentin contract.
Looks good.
No brainer. I move to accept your.
You guys, if you want, you could approve this, and that way, then it's already approved and it's in place, just waiting for the agreement to get approved. And once like the state approves the agreement, which we before a board meeting that you approve it, I can then send this to the union and kind of start that process with them and get ahead of things a little bit.
Is that a change to the agenda?
No. I mean, the recommendation is to review it. That's just my recommendation. You guys can take other actions or provide direction as the board.
I would move that we approve the new institutional utility laborer classification for San Quentin pump station maintenance.
I second that. I'd ask that you look at adding the follow of San Quentin regulations to the
job description
handbook.
Or
appointment the handbook, the employee
employment agreement?
Agreement.
Okay, we'll definitely do that.
I just think it's good to have it in there because I read it in the contract. We have to follow those regulations. I just hate to see us, not follow something and then have our employees say, well, I didn't know. Mm-hmm. I'm supposed to do that.
Oh, yeah. And there's annual training that anybody that has one of these security access cards at San Quentin, there's annual training where we go out onto their grounds and their staff, highlights various things that you can and can't do, like don't talk to the inmates, don't look at the inmates, things like that.
So they shouldn't have a problem.
Yeah.
Okay, it's been moved and seconded. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. No nays? Okay. Item 10, March information items.
Yeah, this is just now we have these on the agenda instead of a separate packet, so that way if you have any questions you want to talk about any info item, we can do that. Mm-hmm. This is the standard monthly report to the Regional Water Board. Nothing for me to point out here that's you can talk about.
Okay. I just wanted to bring up the agenda language for open period for public participation. Commissioner Kelly brought this up at the last meeting, and our general manager has revised or has some proposed language on the open period for public participation that I've reviewed and looks very succinct and very clarifying about what we as board members are allowed to do during the Public Participation Act in accordance with the Brown Act. So any questions, discussions on that? We can have that now.
It's glad it was done.
Thanks. Yeah, Jack, Kobe prepared the language for us, which looked great, and so we're planning to use that on future agendas.
Sounds great.
Okay. Where will it be placed?
That will be placed under the open period for public station
under item 3.
Let's move on to closed
okay.
session.
Okay, closed session.
Excuse me,
North Bay Watershed.
That was a big one this year. Okay. Put your feet up. Oh, wait, there was a flood on 37. They canceled it. So. You can take your feet down now.
Any oral reports by any commissioners? Okay, next scheduled meeting is Tuesday, April 9th at 7 p.m.
I have a oral report. Just briefly, I mentioned the permission to operate. So that was great. We got that.
Excellent.
The agenda language that the chair mentioned. And then lastly, that the Regional Water Board has issued the tentative order for the second watershed permit. Has some new requirements in it. So once that final order is adopted by the Regional Water Board, I'll give you guys a briefing at a board meeting what those requirements are. Nothing to impact the agency, just some additional sampling for the next 5 years. Two other things not on this sheet. One is we have our CASA State Legis meeting tomorrow. So we look at all this new legislation, some we sponsor, so I'll be briefing you guys on that in my little report next month. And then I heard that Representative John Garamendi introduced a major piece of legislation at the House that's important to CASA, and that's extending the MPS permit terms from 5 years to 10 years. Mm-hmm. So we'll see how far that moves along. That's my report.
Okay. Is there a way to support that?
Yeah, I just have, you know, an email from CASA with a letter of support, and I was going to go ahead and edit that and sign it. But it's even better if our board chair signs it.
We'd be happy to.
Okay.
Or you can both sign it.
Yeah. That's we need to get it in by the 25th of March. So
I'm around.
Next week I'll do that, and I'll give you a call, and we can sign over coffee and send it in.
Sounds good.
Okay.
Thank you. Okay. Next meeting, April 9th. We'll adjourn the meeting and go to a closed session.
Does it take like a 2 or 3 minute break or anything?